This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm David Wilk, your host, and today I'm talking to Anya Kamenetz, who's the author of a new book called DIYU, subtitle, Edupunks, Edupreneurs, and the Coming Transformation of Higher Education. How are you, Anya?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm well. So tell me what got you to address this subject in a book. How did you come to this?
Sure. Well, it was a convergence of a couple of factors. So as a journalist, since I got out of college, pretty much I'd been covering the new economics of being young. So I did a column for the Village Voice and then a book on student loans and other factors that affected young people's economic futures. And so I kind of, by default, stepped into the role of student advocate and a commentator on what was going wrong and going on with college costs and college access in this country. And I had moved on from that, and I was working at Fast Company, where we really write a lot about innovation and about technology. And these two have started to come together. I started to realize that, I write a lot about disruptive change in energy, in communications, in media. And I was interested in the question of whether technology and social media could bring disruptive change to this system of higher education, where I saw that there really was a need for something to change.
And, of course, in this book, you start with a discussion about cost and structure of traditional education. Mm-hmm. So you kind of set up the reader, I think, for, I think most Americans feel that something is wrong, especially if their parents who have children who are in college or who have been through college, there's this feeling that the costs are wildly out of control and there's, sort of looking at it as a practical social issue.
Exactly.
You can't figure out why it should cost so much. Yeah, as you compare it to health, health issues, not insurance, but the cost of health is similarly, there are no rational controls at work. And I thought you did a really good job of explaining why it is that traditional college costs so much.
Thank you. Yeah.
And you used Hofstra as a, I guess it's not fair to pick out one college, but you happen to talk to the,
Unfortunately, I have been, yes.
Yeah, and I think, but it applies to all. I mean, and of course, it's a giant system, so there are many, many, many colleges. Maybe you could talk a little bit about how that then, maybe I can ask you the question, because then you bridge to really talking about these other things that are happening as a result of technology and distance learning, people taking control of their lives. And, then you have the disruptors, but there also are really just people who want to take control of their own educational experiences.
Right. Absolutely. Yes. I mean, I think, so what exactly is the question? I'm sorry.
Well, I guess, going from one issue is the social and economic issues of traditional education.
Oh, I see. So I guess I set people up to expect sort of the palliative care solution, which is we can do these administrative changes and we can, improve the system with better incentives and this type of thing. And, I think that kind of change is important, especially, in sort of bridging the gap from one to the other. But it's true that I also am a little bit impatient with that, and I think that the tools of learning are already in people's hands with the Internet and with the age of sort of open courseware and open content. And so a larger, move and a more kind of exciting move in some ways is to talk about how people can use those tools to educate themselves and educate each other.
Right. So, I mean, in fact, there are really two themes at work. One is you can make traditional education structure or traditional educational institutions better, more efficient.
Right.
They can adopt some of the tools, and they can also rethink the way they need to operate because there are all these other factors at work that will probably force them to do that, just like every other institution affected by technology.
Right.
But then, as you said, there's a kind of more interesting, well, I don't know whether it's really more interesting, but it's more exciting to think about how people can take the tools and the thinking. And, of course, I thought this was really interesting that you have people like Ivan Illich and Paulo Freire, who
right.
I read avidly in the 60s, and I really, you know, I came from relatively traditional educational background myself,
right.
but I was enthralled with the idea of breaking down the structures and of people talking to each other as a way of learning and disintermediating the bureaucracy, which, of course, all of those trends existed for the last more than 40 years. You've got, you know,
right.
Rudolf Steiner schools and all these different things that have been going on for many, many years. But what's really exciting is people who took those ideas and applied new technologies to them.
Absolutely. You know, and I think, obviously, I would analogize this to this, you know, it's difficult to draw historical analogies, but certainly this is also a time of great social change. It's a time when traditional categories and ways of life are being very roundly questioned, and that is exactly the moments when people seek to reform institutions like education, because education is sort of the seat of authority itself. You know, it's where we get expertise, it's where we derive a lot of our, even thinking people, because, you know, I think we've sort of transformed as a society from being one that hopefully most of the time makes decisions based entirely on force. And if we transfer from making decisions based on force to decisions then based on money, if we have a corporate-controlled society, but then also based on knowledge and expertise, and that's been sort of the next step. And to the extent that we want a society based on knowledge and expertise and to have the most excellent people and the most, talented people making the decisions, we really need to make sure that our education system is very, very good at identifying those people, allowing them to participate, and making the conversation as broad as possible. And I think those are exactly the flaws that people are pointing at right now.
Well, so do you think, I mean, I guess this sort of comes to another question, which is, you know, somewhat political and maybe challenging, and
right.
that is, recognizing that social change usually comes up against institutionalized power structures
right.
that don't just sit around and say, no problem, we'll give up control. They tend to resist or co-opt in some cases. And so I guess, one of the you sort of have this idea that education is really about, and you pointed this out, I think, later in the book, that only 10% of American people follow the traditional path.
Right.
But that traditional path is built to sustain the economic system, the social structure that we have today.
Right.
Now, some people like that, and other people may oppose it. But
right.
If you posit that the technology and social change movements are going to disrupt that pattern, and that instead of having essentially a system which produces leaders in one category, workers in another category,
right.
you could disrupt that significantly with the kind of thinking that some of your do-it-yourself folks espouse, and whereas others even are using the system itself, which is a profit-based system, to disrupt the profit-based system. How will that play out? Have you thought about, will this really be, and I guess I will say that it that way, will it be allowed to come to fruition, or does it get stamped out because it threatens existing power structures?
Well, I don't want to be too blithe about the consequences of this transformation, because it is not a given that it's going to benefit the folks that I'm trying to think a lot about, who are, the 44% maybe that don't finish college, the roughly almost over 60% that don't get any kind of degree at all, and who are basically relegated in our current system to low-wage jobs unless they manage to learn a trade. Just because the system we have now doesn't benefit the mass of people doesn't mean that the system that we're transitioning to is going to benefit them either. And many people are scared of the collateral damage of the transition. So, I just want to put that out there. At the same time, the amazing thing about the university as a lever or a locus for social change is that it is a very multifarious type of institution. It has protectors from on high in the government worlds, in the business worlds, in amongst clergy members and other places in the wider culture, and most people with any kind of power and influence in our society have association with at least one university. You know, that's just kind of how it works. And by that case, I think you could say that it's going to manage, the university as an institution is going to manage to continue in some form. But it also can evolve very, very quickly because there's a very strange kind of system of dependence and independence. You know, there's sort of a system of firewalls. So, like, you could say that, for example, Harvard is not a very open institution. You know, it hasn't been an exemplar of this open education movement. It doesn't have much of its courseware online. But within Harvard, you know, you have Lawrence Lessig, who's this total apostle of the free culture movement and is doing more than anyone else to change people's ideas about intellectual property and the possibilities for sharing and communicating openly on the web. And he's basically being patronized by, you know, his patron is Harvard University. So that's a very interesting dynamic. And I think that, you know, I think that there can be a lot of resistance to social change from the head office of an institution, and yet down in the trenches or down on the ground, and certainly as students are interacting with professors, change can come.
Well, I think that's right. And, of course, that makes me realize, as you know, as you pointed out, that Massachusetts Institute of Technology has put their entire courseware online as a matter of policy. And that's kind of heavily disruptive coming from the inside out. In other words, they're saying they're kind of opposing the entire methodology of pedagogy that has, you know, that we exist by. You know, the idea that somebody really has a body of knowledge and you have to pay a lot of money to get it.
Right.
They're disrupting right there, and you know, a lot of the, of course, a lot of the issues a lot of the issues that face people in education are financial, and you know, the college, the loan system, I think the number you quoted was $730 billion.
That's the total outstanding student loan burden. So if you think of the millions of graduates who have been, you know, averaging, you know, $23,000 for bachelor's degrees and $100,000 for law degrees, so that's everybody's debt all added up together.
Right. That's a lot of money.
A lot of money.
And it prevents them, what it does, it has the effect of enforcing them to toe the line in terms of the path of their development as, you know, as kind of economic participants in the society, because the minute you get out of college or law school or medical school or whatever profession you've entered, you owe so much money that you have to go out and get a job. You don't have the opportunity to explore these other possibilities. So one of the things that I thought was pretty interesting, and I think you get to this especially in your last chapter, the resources chapter, where you have just huge amounts of information that I don't think we can try to cover here. But what you lay out is a sort of like a Buddhist fourfold path for self-education, or for creating, a kind of self-directed educational program. And what I thought was interesting there in terms of thinking about what an educational experience could be post high school, because we're not even addressing, you know, whether the high school system works or, you know, public education below the the second, you know, the college level, which is a whole other discussion.
Right, sort of broken all the way down.
Right, but assuming, let's say, you get out of high school and you're looking ahead at the future, you do in fact have options other than the traditional 4-year college, other than the perhaps crippled community college system, other than the trade school. What you point out is that it is possible now to follow your own path in a meaningful way, not just as a, you don't have to feel that you're in some way giving up what is real, because we do have this kind of unquestioned belief that if you don't go to college, then you're a failure.
Right, and especially if you don't finish college, which is sort of ludicrous when you think about the fact that almost half of people don't finish. You know, is it really true that number of people in America are just doomed to be failures in life, or is it just that the system is extremely leaky?
Well, it is interesting because, then it gets you to questioning what are the true values of the society as a whole.
Right.
What is the definition of success? If you accept the definition of success that it is getting the highest possible paying job, or the entering a business where you get to be an owner and direct other people and take advantage of the of capitalism, then maybe college is a requirement, or maybe not for all, but certainly if you want those badges, then you have to go through the system for the most part.
Well, it's really interesting that you say that because, you know, one sector of society that I find that is actually not so diploma-bound and diploma-centric is the entrepreneurship world. I mean, there's many handy examples of people who are successful business owners of quite large businesses who are either college dropouts, like Bill Gates, or who never went to college in the first place. And, you know, I think that that's a very old kind of American story. It's something that goes back to probably the days of, you know, the great industrialists in the 19th century. And it's ironically, actually, the progressives world. It's the world of the nonprofits and the world of, you know, media, academia itself, obviously, and then many of the professions, which tend to be full of, you know, fairly liberal, progressive people that do depend on advanced degrees and do depend on professional degrees. And so,
oh, that's actually, no, I think that's a really important point. It is sort of ironic that, you know, in the that the professions produce among them, the you know, most of the, well, I don't want to say most of the liberals, but there are so many liberals who espouse progressive views, but they adhere to this idea that in order to be accepted in your profession, you have to have the degree, the advanced degree.
Absolutely.
That's
absolutely
a good point.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's an admirable thing in some ways because it's, you know, it's about education. It's about all these great liberal values that we're transmuting across, you know, through the format of the four-year degree. But it's exactly that desire amongst an increasingly large number of people to have some simulacrum of the four-year Yale or Harvard experience that has driven up the cost so much and has made it so prohibitive for so many others.
So do you think the numbers are going to reach the point? I mean, you always imagine a certain kind of tipping point idea. You know, one of the questions I have is, can a typical small college or university that is not at the top charge so much for the degree that no longer has the same meaning? You know, will there be disruption at that level where, of course, you know, the Harvards and the Yales and the Princetons, Cornell, all of, you know, the high-end public, private universities and even the high-end public universities are probably not going to see themselves completely out of business.
Right.
But you wonder about some of the smaller schools where they can't get the economies of scale. They don't offer a really compelling reason to pay $55,000 a year. And then you have some of the kids that are coming up through an educational system where they're used to self-definition. You know, you would expect to see them questioning the meaning of paying so much money for an education.
Right, absolutely. But there's still a feeling of, you know, in a world where so much is uncertain, there is that feeling that you can rely on at least the imprimatur of a college degree. You ask what these private colleges might have to do or what some small colleges might have to do. There's a couple of examples. I think one is the flexibility to create sort of lower-priced versions of what they do, either on satellite campuses or in the evening hours or possibly online, and combining online with in-person courses.
Right, and you also mentioned the idea, which I thought was brilliant, of shortening the time that you go through the school.
Oh, very, very much so. You know, the idea of a low residency bachelor's degree, I think, has yet to be really tried in a setting where, you know, here's sort of the crucial move. You know, you have these for-profit schools that have exemplified a lot of the innovation so far in higher education delivery, but they do not have really the prestige, right? So they're kind of missing the X factor that allows people to trust and say this is a real degree and this is worth something. So what you need, I think, is for existing institutions that have some legacy of a proven reputation to be able to leverage that reputation into a new kind of innovative way of delivering it. And, you know, that could be something where you go for the summer and you meet with a cadre of professors and students and you you'd figure out what your role is going to be for the coming year. You know, you're going to take on a year-long research project. Then you go back to your field, wherever that might be, and you're researching on your own, you're working from home, you're communicating and collaborating online. And then maybe you return at the holidays, in the middle of the year, or you return the following summer, and you enact the project together. So you're kind of reversing the academic calendar, and obviously reversing the amount of time that you're spending in school versus doing your own thing.
Right, and it would seem that one revolution would be for some of those institutions that have the credibility to merge or adopt some of the techniques and maybe even the institutional connections of some of the things that don't have. They have maybe the ability to reach students and train them quickly, or maybe train them more efficiently, I should say, whereas the institutions which have credibility have the ability to give that imprimatur and to make sure that the values are still adhered to, that the educational quality is still there, even though, of course, what is the educational quality may be redefined. That's another thing that that you suggest in this book, is the definition of what is an education is up for grabs. That
absolutely,
that people, and as one, you give the example of the woman who created the sketchy art school.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was great, and it doesn't necessarily have to be art, which I think some people could say, well, you could do that in art, but you couldn't do that in science, which is completely untrue. And you couldn't do it in law or medicine. And, I wonder about that as well. You can certainly create alternative methods of training a lawyer. I mean, I think it wasn't that long ago that a couple of hundred years ago, lawyers didn't go to law school.
I still don't think you have to go to law school to take the bar exam.
No, you could be self-trained.
Yeah, absolutely.
Or you could... as some guys in jail have done, just study the books. If you know the material, it doesn't really matter whether you've been to a class or not. And with the number of online classes available, and that's something also you talked about that I thought was really interesting. I think that there's this sense that, pedagogy is really a sort of, or maybe I'm making this up, but I think there's the sense that it's just not as good as face-to-face. But I think you give some examples of the combination of higher touch and online pedagogy, where in fact the teaching can be made better.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the thing is that we're all living in a hybrid world now, where even with people that are the closest to us in the world, we still spend a lot of time communicating with them. Most of us through email or through chat or through text, and that we don't feel any less close, I don't think, to our loved ones because that happens. And I think the same thing can be true in a pedagogical setting. The benefits of being face-to-face are largely intangible. It doesn't mean that they're not important, but it also doesn't mean that you have to spend... I talked to a guy today at lunch, and he said, it's great that we're sitting here exchanging ideas face-to-face. It doesn't mean that I have to move in with you.
Right. That undercuts the notion of the bureaucratic structure of institutions.
Right.
I think that's what Illich and Freire were talking about, that the structure, the bureaucracy of the institution, in fact, after a period of time, gets in the way of the original idea of learning.
I think that's one of the hardest things about this, or imagining what DIYU might mean, is... I had a response online from someone who talked about how, I think this is a great vision, but it's very incomplete because we still don't know how we're going to deliver services to the students who are the most vulnerable and the most in need of help, right? And that's a very reasonable thing to say. It's very clear that the people that are most able to take advantage of open educational resources are the ones who are already very smart, very intelligent, autodidacts, right? The cream of the crop. At the same time, what that explanation kind of misses is the idea that if it's a truly open educational innovation, then it's not about delivering services to students. It's about people learning.
That's right, which could be defined as mentoring. I mean, for a lot of the people that person you're talking about might be worried about, which is the at-risk student, the person who has no advantages, for whom education is a huge struggle.
Right.
Actually, for them, an institution may not be the answer. It may be as simple as finding one person who can teach them, almost like the old-fashioned apprenticeship program, that in fact is a viable educational institution, which is simply one person teaching another.
Well, I would actually go a step beyond that and say the crucial thing that has to happen is for people to be able to, you know, this at-risk person or this, you know, this person in their community to be able to have the freedom to discover what it is that they are motivated to learn and that they are motivated to do and to work on. And it's been shown, for example, in some of the only really rigorous study of any educational intervention that vocational high school programs work really, really well for urban young men. And one of the reasons that this is the case, and it works well in the sense that they go to college. They graduate high school and they go to college at much higher rates, and they end up earning more money. And the speculation is that the reason that this works so well is that people simply, you know, if you're in a very violent neighborhood and you have a lot of economic worries, that by the time you get to be about eighth grade, what you really would like to be doing is earning money and protecting yourself. Those are your major concerns. And therefore, you start to check out of school because school is not helping you do those things. If, however, you are learning to fix cars or you're learning to farm or you're learning to, you know, do any number of things within a vocational setting, then you do have a sense of mastery and you do have a sense that what you're learning is connected to being able to make money. And therefore, you're much more motivated to stay in school. And so I think, you know, again, like, I mean, I agree with you that mentoring is a very important piece of this, but it's very subtle. It's sort of like, you know, again, I would say it's not open education unless it's about a person discovering for themselves what they find interesting.
Right. No, I think that's right. Well, that sort of is a good bridge to my next question. It, you know, based on the most recent article I've seen of yours, it looks like you're now moving into the early education area. You have an article called A is for App, which is about little kids. And the reason I mention this is it seems that there is yet to be uncovered how this will evolve over the next 20 or 30 years. Because kids now who are being 2 and 3 and 4 and 5 years old are learning in different ways, and that's got to have an effect on higher education.
Oh, no doubt. No doubt, because they are learning from the age of 6 months, picking up these cell phones, that they have the ability to manipulate objects around them, to interface with them and to play games and to read stories. You know, I was some open education advocate talking about how his three-year-old daughter referred to the Kindle as Daddy's book. And so she's going to grow up expecting that any book she picks up has any book inside it.
Right.
You know, and infinitely. And, you know, and that's kind of terrifying if you think, you know, there's something about intellectually having the power and ability to concentrate on a 300-page novel or a 700-page novel. At the same time, it's fascinating because, you know, the amount of energy, of ability to express and connect and just follow their own curiosity that I've seen in kids and I've heard that kids can do all over the world is just totally tremendous.
Right. Even those ads that you see, I forget who they are, but it's, you know, when you the kids who are sitting in the classroom saying, we're going to China, and, you know, they go to the big screen TV, which is essentially connected to China and the boundaries. So when instead of growing up with China as a mysterious other, it can be just like somebody down the street.
Right.
And that experiential learning has profound effects on how people interact with each other and whether they trust and are able to work together. And I would argue that the optimistic view of this is that we need to change the way we relate to each other and to the natural world if human beings are going to survive. And
absolutely.
Hopefully these tools are positive. And I think there is a whole movement toward adopting the tools of technology to enable people to be cooperative. I don't know whether this will actually come to pass any more than anybody else does, but I think it probably means for you, if you continue to be a journalist in this area, you'll have lots to write about for the next 10 or 15 years.
Yes, I find it extremely exciting.
Well, it's great. I really love talking to you, Anya, today. This has been Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I've been talking to Anya Kamenetz, who's the author of DIYU, which a new book about education, which I highly recommend. Thank you very much.